One of my favorite guests here on Coast to Coast AM. He's with me tonight, Mike Keiser. We're going to talk about his work, The Apocalypse, The Facade, The Bible Code Myth, and the work of the late Zechariah Sitchin. Lots to cover in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Mike Keiser, Dr. Mike Keiser, expert in ancient languages, religions, texts, particularly the Hebrew Bible and ancient Near East. After teaching on the college level for about 12 years, Michael became the academic editor of Logos Bible Software. In 2005, he was named by Fate magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in ufology. He's had a long, lifelong interest in paranormal, especially the ancient astronauts' theory and UFOs. And here he is on Coast to Coast, Mike Keiser. Michael, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing really well, George. And before we begin, I should say thank you that you and your staff were able to get me on as a guest before the world ended.
We had to squeeze you in fast, huh?
Well, next, I
want to spend a lot of time talking about apocalyptic things with you next hour, Michael. But in a nutshell, just so everybody doesn't panic until we get to that hour, I think we're going to be around on Saturday morning, don't you?
I do. I certainly hope so. I have 5 fantasy football teams in my Super Bowl this weekend, and I better make it. You know?
Yes, and I'm on a plane headed for St. Louis in a blizzard, so... They haven't been hit yet, but it could happen. It could be on that way. Hey, I want to spend some time with you this hour to talk about the late Zechariah Sitchin and his theories, and to get your take, Michael, on ancient astronauts, and we'll just tie it all together. As you know, I appear quite regularly on the History Channel's Ancient Aliens program. Your take on Sitchin, of course, has been different from most, where you think he has not interpreted those Sumerian texts the right way. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I would say when it comes to the coast-to-coast community, I would be in the minority on that. When it comes to the wide, wacky world of academia, I'm certainly with the majority, so it sort of flips. I'm not opposed to the idea that there could be extraterrestrial life. As a biblical scholar, I don't have any trouble with it theologically, but I don't think that what's been offered as evidence for that is really very good. And when it comes to the textual stuff, you know, having gone back and looked at a lot of these things, and if people want to check up on me, they could go to my website, drmsh.com, and at the top, there's a link to a site devoted to Zechariah Sitchin's theories. And if they go there, they can watch me do exciting things on the web, like search for the term Anunnaki and online Sumerian databases. It's thrilling. I mean, they may have to just sort of hold on to their seat, but I do that because I want people to know that they can access the material. And when I say things like there are certain ideas, not everything, but there are certain ideas that are really core to Zechariah Sitchin's work, that you're going to run a search like that, like I show people, and you're not going to find, for instance, especially tonight, and this is not, I mean, Zechariah Sitchin never claimed a connection between Nibiru and Planet X with 2012, and people can go to his own website, and his webmaster makes that clear. So I don't want to, you know, link him with that, but the idea of Nibiru and a Planet X and the Anunnaki, connecting all those things together. The Sumerian tablets, for instance, don't actually connect those things. So there are some disconnects, you know, that I've sort of focused on the website. But, you know, the whole idea that there could be off-planet life, I don't have any difficulty or any problem with that. But I don't buy into Zechariah's specific trajectories that he makes in that
regard. And tell me why, in terms of... You know, he contended, you know, I've interviewed him several times before he passed on. I was with him when he hit his 90th birthday. When you know, his interpretation, and he used to get really upset whenever I would tell him anybody would question him. But when he interpreted these texts, and first of all, the texts are real, right? Regardless of what they mean. These are real physical things, right?
Well, yeah, they're real physical things, but there are... You know, part of Sitchin's work would be disputed by myself and others because of issues with translation. But then there's this other part where, I mean, I'm being so bold to say that there are certain, again, core ideas that aren't even there. So you can't mistranslate something that isn't actually in a tablet.
I would have loved to have
two sides of that.
I would have loved to have seen you and him together in a room going over them with you saying, show me where it means this, have him point it out, and then maybe have another person in there with you too and say, hey, you're right, or something like that.
Well, the closest we can come to that, again, is to do boring things like I do on my website, where I go up to the electronic text corpus of Sumerian literature. It's been there for a long time. I show people how to type in the Sumerian transliterated spelling for Anunnaki, and then you hit the button and you get the results, and where it says TR, you hit that for the English translation, and it's over 100. I mean, they can go through the results and see whether what I'm saying is correct or not. So we've done this often enough that it's no surprise to you or your Coast audience, you know, to hear me say one of the things I try to do is I try to direct people to primary sources. It's sort of an academic spasm, you know, that I have. I try to direct people to the actual sources and say, look, I know it's not exciting, I know it's tedious, but you need to go look at the material yourself. You don't, you know, don't trust me because I have a PhD. I mean, I don't want people's eyes to glaze over and say, I must listen to this guy. I'd rather have them go look for themselves. And then, you know, when you have questions, then come back. And, you know, it's just something that we're sort of trained as academics to do. And, you know, when you're in a class, you do the same thing. You try to encourage students to go back to primary sources, and so you don't get material that's been filtered and so on and so forth. I think it's important, you know, that we don't lose track of the actual material, because it's the intellectual heritage, it's the intellectual posterity of people, you know, that wanted to be remembered. They wanted their thoughts to be remembered, and so they put them down. That's what writing is all about. Writing is this fantastic thing where you actually create an artifact of your thoughts when you write it down.
Michael, tell us, who were the Sumerians?
Well, the Sumerians lived in, you know, again, one of the regions of what we call Mesopotamia now. Sumer was a city-state, for lack of a better term, among other, you know, city-states in that region. And they had a period of dominance, you know, in terms of throwing their weight around, their authority around in that region. And they eventually, like all empires and all civilizations, you know, they had their day, and then they transitioned out to another culture that gained supremacy, the city of Akkad, the Akkadians. And that's really, it's through the Akkadians that we actually know something about the Sumerians, because the Akkadians adopted their script, their, you know, the cuneiform style, and applied it to their own language. And in doing so, they created what are called lexical lists. They're basically two-column dictionaries, where on the one side is the Sumerian word, and on the other side is the Akkadian word. And so they preserved their language, you know, the Sumerian language, through their own, because then when Akkadian was deciphered, then you could go back and decipher Sumerian, and that's how we got it. You know, that the Akkadians were, you know, had enough foresight, had enough interest, you know, to preserve the literary heritage of their neighbors.
What happened to these people, Michael?
Well, usually, again, in this region, it happens in Egypt a lot, happens across the board in the ancient Near East, it happened in Canaan. A lot of this is environmental. Over and over again, you will see references in text to environmental conditions that, you know, are not favorable, either droughts, extended droughts that affect, all of these are river civilizations. If your audience remembers, thinks back to their high school history class or their Western civilization class, all of these civilizations in Mesopotamia, and of course, Egypt, you know, the Nile, they're river civilizations, because that's their sustenance. When we have the Neolithic transition to settled living, as opposed to hunting and gathering, well, the logical place is you find a water source, and then you you know, you can grow things, you have domesticated agriculture, and you settle in those areas. Well, anything environmental that upsets that apple cart is going to have a dramatic effect. And again, that happens with all these civilizations. And in the case of the Sumerians, there was that impact, and then also friction between their neighbors that, you know, sort of had something to do with their decline. It wasn't a sudden thing, but they gradually declined, and again, some of their neighbors were able to conquer them and gain supremacy in the region.
Okay, so Sitchin would say, and I'll just do a paraphrase of his work, that there was a planet in our solar system on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit. Mm-hmm. It was called Nibiru. Mm-hmm. The inhabitants of the planet, the Anunnaki, they had something going on wrong in their atmosphere, and for some reason needed to sprinkle gold dust in there. So they went searching throughout the heavens for a planet that had this mineral, and it was us. So the Anunnaki came here. They decided after a while they didn't want to do the work, so they genetically altered mankind, and voila, here we are. Now, here's my question to you, Michael. Mm-hmm. Is there anything close in your interpretation of the text that Sitchin came up with? I mean, is there any similarities, or is he just totally off compared to what you've done?
Well, again, I'm going to make the bold claim and say those core ideas are actually not in the tablets. And I invite people
to
look.
At all.
At all. Let me give you some examples. Nibiru, of course, is in tablets. They're in astronomical texts from Mesopotamia. Nibiru is identified. And again, if people go up to the website and click at the top on the Sitchin link, the website is drmsh.com. Nibiru, again, you can click on the Nibiru tab when you get to that site. I have a table of all the occurrences of Nibiru. So Nibiru is associated with Jupiter. It's associated with the planet Mercury. And it's also associated with an unnamed star. And then in some cases, it's not associated with anything at all. It just refers to a crossing point. And that's sort of the fundamental meaning of the term. So it's never actually referred to as a planet or planetary body or any celestial body beyond Saturn, because in the Mesopotamian astronomical texts, the Mesopotamians, the Sumerians, and the Akkadians, and the Assyrians and Babylonians only knew of the planets up to Saturn. So you never get any other planet beyond that. So right there's a fundamental disconnect. And I don't think that the Mesopotamians were confused about Nibiru, that it gets referred to with all these different things. I think they were marking some sort of movement in the sky, some sort of crossing pattern, maybe, you know, where Jupiter did this or that. In one text, Nibiru is said to occur every year. So right away, that tells you that's some sort of astronomical event, but it's not every 3,600 years, it's every year. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they were confused, but I think that what happens with Zechariah Sitchin is he's looking at the text and he creates essentially an allegory. So he takes the data and then he connects certain data points within the texts. And what I'm saying is some of those connections he makes and some of the meanings that he assigns to them are of his own idea. They're his own creation. That the narrative is essentially his own creation, the story, you know, that he has published in his, you know, range of books. But yeah, the tablets are real. The Anunnaki show up a lot. They're never in any tablet connected with Nibiru. There's never a tablet that connects the Anunnaki with gold, mm-hmm. for instance. So you have these fundamental points of disconnect.
What about the genetic altering of what species might have been on the planet?
Well, the Anunnaki are in they're in a scene where humanity is created, but the humanity is actually created not by the Anunnaki. They're created by a single deity that slays another deity and then mixes the blood of that deity with clay. But the Anunnaki are watching. They're sort of in the room watching what's going on. The picture that I always think of is, you know, like on TV, you have medical students that are sort of
hanging around,
watching the surgery,
yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So
they're holding an organ in their hand. Look at the liver.
Yeah, they're in the room, and that's actually similar to what you get in Genesis 1, where you have God say, let us create humankind in our image. And grammatically, what that is that the single deity, in this case, Yahweh, the God of Israel, because it's the Hebrew Bible, says to a group, you know, somewhere in the room, hey, let's do this. But then when the creation actually occurs, all the verbs are singular and the pronouns are singular. So it says that God, he created them in his. Notice the singular pronouns, his image, and he created. So it's very clear. It actually is a lot like the Sumerian story in that respect. You have a single creator, and you have others watching. And again, my specialty is something called the Divine Council, the pantheons or heavenly host. That's the kind of thing I get into. So there's some conceptual similarity there. So they are in the room, so to speak, but they're not the ones actually doing anything. They're keeping their eye on what's going on.
This I'll call it a misinterpretation, and I'm riding the fence here, but I'm just taking the devil's advocate position.
You pick any side you want, George.
How could he be, in your opinion? In your opinion, how could he be so wrong?
Well, I don't think that. You know, I think there was a fascination there with the stories. And, you know, I hate to draw the correlation because I think of people like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, who actually fashion narratives that are fictional, but they have touch points with items in text and mythologies and so on and so forth. So to me, that's the kind of thing he's doing. But of course, you know, Zechariah Sitchin didn't present it as fiction. So I think at some point he got so into it that the ideas were so appealing that he, you know, began to really say, hey, I'm onto something and really believe that. But I don't know that. I can't psychologize him, but I don't think there's, and I know there are people who disagree with me this, but I've just said it for years. I do not think there was any sort of evil intent on his part. I've had other people, other talk show hosts, just try to say bad things.
That he was lying, basically.
I just don't think there's malice.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you. And, well, you know, it is what it is. Now, based on what might have been happening in those days, are the stories coming out of Sumer, are they similar to stories in Genesis? Is there any correlation there?
Well, the one that I just mentioned, I mean, there's going to be some, again, conceptual overlap, you know, within any, you know, any culture that's going to be writing about, you know, gods and inhabitants of their spiritual world and all that sort of thing. You know, part of what those beings do is, of course, create humanity. And so all of, you know, the Mayans did the same thing. I mean, they have their own story of how, you know, humanity was brought into existence and so on and so forth. So there's bound to be similarities, you know, in sort of fundamental questions. How did we get here? Why are we here? You know, what we know, there's a distance between us as humans and this other realm, you know, these other beings. And so what does that look like? You know, what do those other beings do in relationship to us? How do we please them? How do we offend them? What do we do if we offend them? So these sorts of questions for any culture that is theistic or polytheistic or whatever, you know, whatever term you want to describe it, they're asking the same questions. They're operating from the same presuppositions. And so there's bound to be, again, conceptual.
We're going to come back with more with you, Michael Heiser, and then we're going to talk about the Mayan doomsday apocalypse. That's next. Well, on our next Coast to Coast show, of course, it's going to be our Mayan calendar program. We're going to have a number of guests on. We'll take your calls as well. And tonight with Michael Heiser, let's get his take on some of this doomsday prophecy next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Mike Heiser, my guest tonight. Okay, here we go. We're leading up to this incredible day tomorrow night, Michael, and in some time zones, we now are at 12:21. What's your take of this whole Mayan prophecy, doomsday?
Well, yeah, I don't put a whole lot of stock in as far as a doomsday prophecy. The Mayans never actually said, you know, anything about the end of the world. It's just that they're their calendar, and the long calendar ends, and we've sort of filled in this gap that this calendar ends, and so that must mean something. And it goes back to the late 80s with Jose Argel's his book The Mayan Factor, and it's just sort of, you know, taken hold of pop culture ever since. But I don't think the Mayans, if they were here, I think they would have been happy. They would have been celebrating, because it was a big deal to be at the close of one of these cycles, because they were really about, you know, the new beginning on the other side. So I think we've sort of filled in that negative feel to it.
Well, maybe so. We shall find out soon enough. I've always said I think we could be in a window that could go a year either way. What do you think?
I think culturally, you know, and I don't think this has anything to do with the Mayans or anything to do with specific biblical prophecies either. And I'll get in trouble for that with the Christian crowd. But I do think that in terms of the West and Western culture, you know, we are sort of on a precipice, really a hinge point, largely of our own making through, you know, either ineptitude, or in some cases, I do think, you know, in terms of the leadership, you know, in the West, you know, not just the U.S., but across the board, there's a lot of seeking of control of people's lives. You know, there's financial mismanagement, again, either deliberate or, again, because of ineptitude, and a whole host of things that have been in operation for decades. And we're sort of living at the point now where, you know, it's going to hit the fan, and we have to live through that. You know, you've had plenty of guests, you know, on the show that have gone into all sorts of aspects about that. But, you know, I think, you know, we can't look at the Mayan literature, the Mayan codexes we have, and nothing specific in the Bible pertaining to America or Western Europe. But we still nevertheless find ourselves, you know, living at this juncture.
Why aren't you concerned about this moment?
Well, I'm not concerned about the moment, you know, the turn of the day. I am concerned about, you know, especially in our country, the future of my kids and grandkids, because, again, we've been so irresponsible, especially fiscally, that it would take generations, you know, to fix the problems that we're in. And they got the way they are because of generations of mismanagement. So I am concerned, you know, about that, about the future. I think liberty is fragile. I think liberty could descend into fascism in a very short amount of time. But again, I don't think that has anything specific to do with the Mayans or again, any other specific point of prophecy.
Well, that's true too. That could be. Michael, as you look at where we're headed in the future, do you still think apocalypse, end times, that's on the table?
Well, I think as for anyone who, again, operates, you know, from a Judeo-Christian worldview that has, you know, a reasonably high view of the Old and New Testament, the Bible, I mean, there is this thing, you know, talked about called an apocalypse, the day of the Lord. And in broad terms, it's, you know, and this isn't unique to Judeo-Christian thinking. I mean, you'll find millennial and apocalyptic thinking in all sorts of religions, but it's a time where evil gets punished and right is made right. You know, essentially where things are corrected, reset to the way they ought to be. Evil is punished, righteousness is rewarded. But, you know, before you can have the good come out of it, again, in terms of the Bible, and again in other religions, there's this cataclysmic period that precedes this thing that comes afterwards. And in biblical theology, it has to do with, again, the return of Christ, the resurrection of the dead, you know, the transition to a new heaven and new earth. You know, other religions talk in these terms, but these are the ones that are most familiar to most Americans because of our Western culture. But, you know, that has to be on the table, again, if you buy into, again, any form of Judaism or Christianity where you at least take the text, you know, seriously or semi-seriously, because that's what it says. That's what it describes.
Why don't you put more stock into what people are saying about biblical accounts?
Well, I put stock in the biblical text. What I don't put stock in is a lot of the popular prophecy, you know, the most unfortunate example is, a year ago or whatever, however many months it was, with Harold Camping predicting the end of the world.
Twice.
That sort
yeah.
of thing. I don't put any stock in that sort of thing. And really, a lot of the ideas in popular prophecy are really tenuous when it comes to what the biblical text actually says. And so, I more or less take them with a grain of salt. I've had to teach all this stuff for so many years. Maybe that's in part, what's sort of jading me a little bit, because there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of ambiguity in the biblical text when it comes to prophecy. And in regards to some prophetic things, like the first coming of Messiah and his specific task, we're told in the New Testament that prophecy in that case was deliberately cryptic. I mean, the Apostle Paul actually tells us things like that in one of his letters to the Corinthians. So, prophecy is sort of designed to not be completely clear and to be ambiguous. And so when people, sort of come out and say, well, I know everything that's going to happen. It's all these ducks are going to line up in a row, and I can pick up my newspaper and interpret my Bible by virtue of my newspaper. I don't put a whole lot of stock in that.
Is there any chance that the Bible mentions something reference to 2012?
No, I don't think it has any reference to 2012 at all. I mean, people try to get there through Bible codes and, sort of taking numbers that are given in prophecy. I mean, there's 70 weeks, there's 1260 days, there's 1335 days, there's a smattering of numbers that are involved in apocalyptic passages. And essentially, depending on where you start, depending on what you divide those numbers by, depending on what you multiply them by, and really what scheme you develop to do all those things, you can sort of, do the math. You can sort of work the math to make it, hit on 2012 and different things like this. But these are very contrived things. In the mind of the biblical writer, he's not thinking about December 21st, 2012, even though we can sort of massage different passages and get there on our own just fine.
There's no doubt about that. Well, let's talk about Revelation for a moment. Let's tear that apart. And then I want to compare some of the Hebrew Bible to the King James Version Bible. In terms of where we're headed with Revelation, do you think that could occur?
Well, Revelation is a tough book. The popular assumption, when I say popular, I mean sort of the dominant assumption in books that you'll read that we're familiar with, things like the Left Behind series and whatnot. The assumption is that Revelation is a book designed to be read in a linear way, that it gives a linear chronology from start to finish. That may be, that's possible. If it is, then you're going to have a certain reading of the book. It's also possible that Revelation, the elements in the narrative, repeat themselves in circular patterns. And if you look at the book that way, you come out with a completely different system of end times. So this is sort of illustrative of what I'm talking about. There's a number of just key problems with why prophecy is unclear and why interpretation is uncertain. We often don't know what the original intent of a prophecy was. For even something fundamental like Isaiah chapter 7, having to do with the virgin birth and, interpretation of the New Testament. Everybody knows Isaiah 7:14, behold, the Alma, which is the Hebrew term, will conceive and bear a son, and so on and so forth. But nobody ever looks at the next verse. Verse 15 says that by the time the child can eat solid food, this problem that the prophecy is coming to sort of soothe the fears of the king, King Ahaz, in the context, this problem is going to be taken care of. So right away, that tells you that the original prophecy was intended for King Ahaz, and that's exactly what Isaiah says. This is a sign for you, King Ahaz. Well, then what is Matthew doing, 1,500 years or 1,700 years later, applying this to Jesus? I mean, how does that even work? So you have problems of original intent and what the New Testament does with the old, when the New Testament does quote the Old, oftentimes it assigns fulfillments that are not literal. So how do we know which ones are literal and which ones aren't? There's just a whole number. The rapture, let's take the rapture. The only way you get the idea of a rapture, and for those who the terminology might be unfamiliar here, certain Christian approaches to the book of Revelation will see a second coming, mm-hmm. and before that,
of a Christ figure, right?
Right. Another event where Christians are removed from the earth, and then there's this horrible time of tribulation, and then we have the second coming, Jesus comes back. So there's two events. Well, the only way you get two events out of what the New Testament says is if you take all of the passages that talk about Jesus coming and then focus on the differences, the subtle differences between the passages, and therefore you split them into two categories, and that gives you two events. Well, there a lot of Christians say, well, we shouldn't be splitting them. We should be harmonizing them like we do with the Gospels. You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John record the same event, but they do it in different ways. Some have
and interpreted
detail, another
it
has another set, and we harmonize. So who makes the decision? Who made the rule that we harmonize all this other stuff, but when we get to prophecy, then we split it out so we can get two events? It's just stuff like that, that these are interpretive decisions that are made that produce certain views of end times.
Why do you think that so many interpretations are so different?
I think it's just the difficulty of the task. The Bible doesn't come with a handbook that says, hey, when you get to this stuff over here, you use this approach. You know, we'll just take the rapture thing. Here's your little, it's like a recipe, your instruction book. Gather all prophetic passages together about Jesus' return. Look at them. Look at the details. Put them into columns, and, you know, there you go. Out pops your theology. We don't have instructions on how to do certain things. Probably the best thing we can do is look at the way the New Testament writers interpreted the Old and sort of make some observations. Sometimes they looked at it literally. Sometimes they just saw analogies. Like with Matthew quoting Isaiah 7:14 in reference to Jesus' virgin birth. Okay, Matthew's not a dummy. He knows Isaiah 7. He can read the whole chapter, not just one verse. He knows that it's not, about a virgin birth in Isaiah 7. Okay, it's about the preservation of the line of David, which is the messianic line. And it's a supernatural event. So he traveled with Jesus for 3.5 years. Jesus' mother was part of their little group. So, he's heard the story about Jesus. He knows the circumstances. And so when he gets toward the end of his life and it dawns on him that, hey, I'm getting old, I'm going to die here, I better write this stuff down, he's thinking about the circumstances and he goes, wow, this whole circumstance of what Mary told us about Jesus, this is just like, it's analogous to this thing that happened in Isaiah 7. It was a supernatural event that led to the preservation, of the dynastic line of David. And here we have the son of, so he's striking analogies. It's clear with 2020 hindsight. But our problem is we have prophecies that are projected far distant to our own future. We don't have 2020 hindsight. We have to guess. And so I think it's just the difficulty of the task. And again, I'll go back to this idea. We can talk about it a little later if you want, but there are certain indications in the New Testament that there were some prophecies, especially about the task of Jesus on the cross and all that, that were deliberately designed to be cryptic. I'll give you the passage. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, he says, look, had the rulers of this world known, and that's a phrase, rulers of this world, the Greek word is stoicheia. Paul uses it elsewhere of demonic beings, non-human intelligences. He said, had the rulers of this world known what was going to happen, they would never have crucified the Lord of glory. Because that's the whole key to the kingdom of God in New Testament theology, the salvation of people, the gospel, the whole bit, Jesus' death and resurrection. So he says, look, if they had figured this out, if they could have figured this out, they never would have done it. And so it just tells you that a lot of this was just really under the radar. And so if prophecy sometimes operates that way, the first time around, well, when it comes to future end times events, how do we know that, you know, it's not going to work that way then? That it's just deliberately cryptic. So it's tough. It's hard, you know, to figure out. It's entertaining. It's interesting. But the nature of the task, I just warn people, look, don't get too wrapped up in this, because you'll start to lose your mind trying to figure out all these details. And you're not going to be able to do it anyway.
Do you believe in a higher power, Michael?
Yeah, I believe in God. I believe I'm a Christian as well. I'm sort of an atypical, you know, Christian in certain ways, that I don't really follow any denomination or anything like that, any specific tradition.
Right.
I'm more or less just, what does the New Testament say? What does the Old Testament say? And if a denomination doesn't particularly like, you know, what I'm saying, it, you know, what I'm saying is there from a scholarly perspective, well, oh well, you know, we can be friends, but I'm not going to just ignore what I'm seeing in the text because it's written in some creed somewhere. You know, I think the text itself of again, here we are back to primary texts again. The text itself trumps tradition in my view, and so sometimes it gets me into trouble. Sometimes people like it, you know. Oh well.
Well, you know, what I find amazing is, you know, you believe in extraterrestrial life. You haven't ruled that out. I interpret that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see any reason that has to be ruled out.
What about the stories in Genesis taken out of context? What are they?
Well, you'd have to be more specific as far as, you know, which.
Well, fallen angels.
Oh, fallen angels like Genesis 6?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's... I do not believe in the what's popularly known as the Sethite view. That's the view that came up in the early church to essentially explain this away. That what we have here are not angelic beings and human beings, but we have two lines of human beings, good guys and bad women, mm-hmm. or excuse me, bad guys and, you know,
and good women.
Well, you know, well, you have to flip it at one point, because you have sons of God and human women. Sons of God are good, but then they fall, and so, you know, the human women. The view is that the sons of God are a godly line, and then that what that means is then, oh well, then the daughters of men, they were evil. So it just doesn't sound good. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense either, you know, when you get further down the road into the details. But I think there's really two ways to look at that. One is literally that, hey, the a divine being with divine power has the ability to presume or assume flesh, and flesh is capable of doing what flesh is capable of doing. And so, you know, you have, you know, a literal event, literal cohabitation here. And that is the way it seems that the New Testament writers take it, Peter and Jude specifically. The other way that you could take it is that it's sort of a literary, or what scholars call a mythopoetic device, where the biblical writer, because of what he's going to write later about the conquest of Canaan with the giant clans there.
Hold on for one second, Mike. We're going to hit this break. We'll come right back with you on Coast to Coast AM.